It is true. Birds are forgotten in Yellowstone. I do other things there. Was hired for something else back in 1994, but birds are a passion. And so I crept up on them in Yellowstone, and they've been overshadowed, Yellowstone, oldest park in the world, by large mammals and geology their entire history. And there's a rich, rich resource of birds in Yellowstone. And so all of you folks here who are so enthusiastic birders, we need to get birds on the same level with large mammals, wolves, elk, bison, grizzly bears, those kinds of things, because they need us like we need them. Because birds are everywhere, they're all around. And these other things, you know, it's hard to see a wolf. It's hard to see a grizzly bear. Whenever you want to go out, a bird is there for you. So we need to be there for them. So that's kind of my take-home message for the talk tonight. So what I'm going to do is give a cross-section of what we're trying to do in Yellowstone. You know, a lot of the large mammals, the geology, have been studied for 150 years in Yellowstone. But the bird program only started in the mid-1980s. Even though we do have data on things like trumpeter swans back to 1917, there wasn't an official program in place. So what we've been trying to do the last few years is really build a science-based program that's based on government monitoring. Those are two different things. Government monitoring is long-term, and you get out there every year and you do it and you look at trends. And science is based on kind of questions and hypotheses and publishing, and we're trying to do both. So this is what the Yellowstone Bird Program is focused on now. I threw in a picture of a Clark's Nutcracker. We have not started on that study yet. That funding is in the works this winter. But as you know, white bark pine is a critical forest type, high elevation in this region throughout the Northern Rockies. And most of their seeds are established by caching by Clark's Nutcrackers. And so everybody's focused on white bark pines. So we want to focus, we're going to start a study this summer focused on the birds. Diana Tomback at University of Colorado, Denver. Anyways, so that's just an intro to them. But I want to talk about songbirds, raptors, swans, loons, the Molly Islands in Yellowstone Lake, where we have colony nesting bird colony, and ravens. We're just starting a study with ravens with Bern Heinrich, who you probably heard of, who wrote Ravens in Winter and Mind of the Raven, and John Marsloff, and then some folks from Germany. So that's a cross-section of what I want to do. Some slides will be fast because I know you just love pretty pictures, and other slides will have some data because it, you know, you have to be based in something solid, something scientific. We need that in our world today. And so this is what it's all about. This is Sacagawea Audubon. You're all passionate birders. And when you see a picture like this, what I want you to get is the feeling of being out on a morning like this. Because this is when those little guys are out. The plethora of birds are amazing, but this is the songbird time. And if you've ever read any of Donald Kreutzmann's stuff, he's out an hour before first light, because you're gonna start hearing those early songs. So this is actually kind of late. And I know it's December, holiday season, but this is why we do it, right here. That feeling, that's where they are. That's Glen Crick in Yellowstone. And that's a Wilson's warbler. You all know that one. And they're willow nesting obligates. And we've had a lot of work being done on what does the return of wolves mean to the park. You know, there's cougars have come back. Grizzly bears have increased. That's affected elk. It's a long story, and I don't want to get into it tonight, but that's affected willows. And so that's affected these guys. And that's affected willow flycatchers as well. And we're trying to stay on top of that like we are the wolves and elk and cougars. And so here we are. This is out doing early morning songbird surveys. This is a study that we started in 2008 based on Lisa Burrell's work at Montana State. She did her master's degree on birds that live in willow communities that have been impacted by heavy elk browsing versus stands that were not. And we have continued that study after her master's. And we were also doing some sound recordings as well. And so songbirds are up against it. What they're so amazing in my entire life, I mean, they're this big on average. And they fly to Central and South America every year, two times a year. I mean, that's an incredible journey that I'm inspired by every time I see one every spring, those neotropical migrants. And they have all sorts of issues facing them now. This one lately has been one of the biggest discoveries of how many songbirds are killed a year by free-ranging cats. And so about half of the songbird guilds are declining, especially the grassland guild, and I'll get to that in a minute. So this is a big issue for Yellowstone, and we want to be monitoring songbird trends in the park. And so one thing that we have done this year for the first time is we have established a MAPS station in Yellowstone. Monitoring avian productivity and survival, we have started a MAPS station in Yellowstone. It's an international mist netting program for the first time this year. So for the first time in Yellowstone's history, we are mist netting and leg banding songbirds. Katie Duffy, a partner on this, she tells me she has banded more than 10,000 songbirds, but this is that station at Blacktail Deer Creek. This is Lauren Walker. She just graduated from the University of Washington, a PhD. She did it on black cat vireos. She did her master's in Mount Rainier on corvids and interactions with people, but there she is. She's got the banding permit. A McGillivray's warbler. Female. That's not a we didn't catch a lot of those at this MAPS station. This is blacktail, beautiful, beautiful bird, very common around this area. And this is a yellow warbler. This is the most common species that we caught at this banding station. And so what kind of data are we getting? And so this is, we did a number of runs. These are the dates that we set the nets up. And this is the adult birds that we caught, the totals, and this is the juveniles. And we really had a spike. We thought we were gonna start getting, you know, we think these birds nest in June, and you know, they only have about a 10, 12, 14 day incubation. They're nestlings for a few weeks, and then we thought we'd start seeing them in late July. We didn't really start getting juveniles until August. And so that was something very interesting. As you can see here, there's quite a bit of variability in the days you go to get the adults, but these young birds aren't coming on, and this was just the first year we did this, but they were coming on a lot later than we thought they would. So late August, and we had a couple rain events here in June. Songbirds, as you know, if they get a full day of rain or 2 days of rain, it can wipe out their entire nesting attempt for that year. So this is just our first year of doing this, and this is the first year's of data. And then we have breeding bird routes, and those have been going in Yellowstone since the mid-80s. Terry McEnany started those in the park. This is the mammoth route. This is the mammoth route. This is the northeast route, and this is the Yellowstone route. John Parker of Sacagawea Audubon fame does this route. He does that route. And Katie Duffy does that route. And so those three routes have been going for over 30 years. That's an international survey, as you know. Here's John. Early morning, Lamar Valley, not quite sure what he's surveying there. Maybe songbirds, as you know, because he's one of your own, one of the best birders I've worked with. He is a crack birder. So we appreciate, we want to keep John going as long as we can doing those routes. And so the breeding bird surveys, as I mentioned, have a fairly long history in Yellowstone. This is two of those routes. And there's quite a bit of year-to-year variability. This is the total number of birds seen, just songbirds. And you can see that during the late 80s, early 90s, bird numbers were higher, and then they've been trending down. And it's hard to interpret why they are doing that. You know, so what we have, the 88 fires here. We have predator recovery, at least wolf reintroduction here. You could argue that cougars and bears were a wider bar than that, but they were coming back during that time period. And then we have climate change going throughout this entire period. So this is one of the best long-term data sets we have on songbirds in Yellowstone. And, you know, why is our general trend down? It's hard to say. But these are some of the obvious possibilities here. And this is one of the big causes for concerns that you see in the bird literature. Why this long-term decline in songbird numbers? One thing that's changed a lot since I've been there, I got to Yellowstone in 1994, you didn't see Canada geese everywhere. I fly a lot just because of my job. All these projects I'm involved with require a lot of flying around an airplane in Yellowstone. And, you know, when I started, you didn't see Canada geese everywhere. Now every wetland in Yellowstone, they're around. And this is the breeding bird survey data we have, but their trend line is increasing. And we don't know what that means. Are they competing with other wetland birds? Are they aiding things like bald eagles? Because bald eagles prey on the goslings, and then bald eagles occasionally prey on things like loons and swan cygnets. So we don't know what this relationship, but these Canada geese have really taken off. And in fact, the Yellowstone breeding bird survey route, I helped John do it. And when we get to Hayden Valley, John counts songbirds and I count Canada geese, because it just takes one person to count all the geese. So we don't, and I have nothing against Canada geese. They're very, you know, they're monogamous, lifelong mates, great parents. Nothing against Canada geese, but it's kind of, you know, back here people were worried about them in the 60s, and they've really increased. So what does that mean for other birds in the park? And the other thing, as all of you know, because it's climate change, we're hearing about it all the time. There's a climate change conference in Poland right now. So we have to adapt to this, and, you know, we're trying to do a better job monitoring climate change effects. You know, can we do anything about it? That's another issue. But one thing we're seeing is this is the date of arrival. So this is just counting the days since the beginning of the year, just sequentially. And so you can see that these are trending down. And the trending down means they're arriving earlier. Now, of course, all of you know that there's several different classes of migratory birds. There's migratory birds like waterfowl that just go as far south as they need to go to find open water and food. And then you have neotropical migrants who go way far away. And so they're programmed by evolution when to come back. So they could be messed up more by changing weather because they're just indeterminate. You know, they just fly back at the same, when we monitor the warblers, they come back within 2 or 3 days of the same date every year. But waterfowl, birds that don't go far, they're monitoring local weather conditions. And so if it's a mild winter, they come back earlier because they want to get started earlier. So if conditions change to go bad, they can get caught. It can be worse for them. So we want to keep track of these type of things. But the trend everywhere in the world, and in Yellowstone too, is to come back earlier. We started 3 years ago. One of the things that climate change is going to do is burn these old growth forests more. Old growth forests are largely comprised of Engelmann spruce and subalpine fir, and they're more prone to burning than is lodgepole pine. So these are 200 to 300-year-old forests. They dry out very quickly. They become tinder boxes. And there are a unique group of birds that use them. So we, thrushes, this looks like a hermit thrush, a brown creeper, This is a vireo, Cassin's vireo, I believe. And so what we want to do is we want to get a baseline data of these birds that are using these mature forests. And possibly, this is a hard thing to do, to change park management. Because, you know, we went from a period of time, this is controversial, and I'm glossing over many details here, but, you know, we went from a period of time in Yellowstone when all fires were bad to a time now when all fires are good. You know, we suppress fires, and they have a natural ecological function, and suppressing them was bad, and that was true. But now with climate change, letting everything go with greater fire intensity and frequency, we got to start thinking about, some of the models predicted is we're not going to have forests over 75 to 100 years old in 50 years. And so all of these species that we have could go. So the only way to deal with this is to get baseline data on some of these species. And so here's what we get. Swainson's thrush. This is our average abundance in lodgepole. Not very good. This is a mix of lodgepole pine and Engelmann spruce, subalpine fir, better. And then Douglas fir, it goes back down again. So this is old growth here. Warbling vireo is kind of the same pattern. So these are some of these species that are using these old growth stands. This is the riparian areas. I already talked a little bit about this, the willow. We already talked about the Wilson's warbler, very tall. This is suppressed willow. Willets recently released from ungulate browsing, but they're all in this tall stuff. Same with fox sparrow. And actually, to tell you the truth, that's a fox sparrow, Wilson's warbler. We've only got a couple spots in Yellowstone where we really get fox sparrows. That they're a very rare sparrow in the park. And then these are the willow flycatchers that come back in some of these willow stands, and so have catbirds and marsh wrens. So we've really seen a response the last 10 years or so in recovering willow stands that were previously browsed heavily by ungulates, that some of these birds have been coming back. So grassland sagebrush-loving birds are probably the guild of songbirds that are declining at the highest rate in North America. And so we had a student at University of Montana, Danielle Faggery, do a two-year study in Yellowstone and the National Bison Range north of Missoula, and we've continued her study. Young people oftentimes have great ideas, and actually I was embarrassed. Why aren't we monitoring songbirds when 80% of northern Yellowstone is sagebrush grassland steppe? So we have started monitoring this Brewer's sparrow, lark sparrow, western meadowlark, Brewer's sparrow, sage thrasher, green-tailed towhee. And if you've ever heard these guys sing, they compete with the orchestra pit right here. They are fabulous, fabulous singers. Not that common, as well as the western meadowlark. So we want to get baseline data on these guys. And we've also looked at forest burns because of this climate change issue of increasing fire frequency. We're getting more forest fires in Yellowstone. And so what species come in after forest fires? So not only looking at what's there beforehand, old growth forests, what are we getting afterwards? And so, you know, things like tree swallows, dark-eyed juncos, and the woodpecker guild does hit the black pole trees quite heavily after fires. So we're monitoring those long-term as well. We only do it for 5 years post-fire. These are the woodpeckers. And this is the secondary nesters there coming in afterwards. Here is a hairy woodpecker. Not in a fire, a post-fire community, but they're hard to get pictures of. Moving on from songbirds, when I inherited the bird program in 2008, the only raptor species that we monitored were bald eagles, ospreys, and peregrine falcons. So there's a lot of other species that use Yellowstone. We actually determined there's 19 different raptor species that nest in the park, and we only had data on those three species. So we got funding for a five-year program that we called the Yellowstone Raptor Initiative, and we decided that we would look at these other species that had no data, that were not being monitored, and how well are they doing, and are there any conservation concerns there? We immediately discarded the accipiters. Goshawks, Cooper's hawks, and sharpshinned hawks all live and nest in Yellowstone, but each one of those species almost requires an entire research effort by themselves. So we could not do that. They're forest nesting raptors, extremely hard to census. So we immediately said we can't do anything with those. But we really decided to focus on golden eagles because they're of conservation concern across the West. Wind farms may be impacting their abundance. There's some debate about are they stable or declining. But red-tailed hawks are everywhere. So people tend to avoid the common species. So this is our bread and butter species. So we thought we needed a baseline, a five-year baseline on how are our most common raptors doing. So sometime in the future, 15, 20, 25 years, when there's environmental change, someone could come back and rigorously resample red-tailed hawks to compare how they've been doing over time. And then we thought we would try Swainson's hawks. There's a garbage man I know. He was a maintenance guy at Lake in the 1970s. Rumor has it he showed up for this talk. And these Swainson's hawks come from Argentina, and they get to Yellowstone after the red tails do. So it looks like the red tails settle the good spots, then the Swainson's come in and get the secondary spots, which tend to be slightly higher elevation. They're very, very hard to find nests. They're very, very hard to determine productivity. This maintenance man at Lake told me he's an expert at it. I'll get to that in a minute. We worked with him for a few years to help us. So we picked them. We thought kestrels too. Kestrels are declining in the East at least, unsure about the West. And then prairie falcons we decided to sample because we've had a big return of peregrine falcons in Yellowstone. I'll talk about that in a minute. And we were wondering, well, maybe they've declined because peregrines have moved in and displaced them from some areas. So we called this the Yellowstone Raptor Initiative. But what we really worked on was the golden eagles and the red-tailed hawks. And so this is what the red-tails were doing. This is their nest success in blue, and this is their productivity in black. So this was a five-year study. That's all the funding we could get. Many park administrators hate when you come to them and say, I promise you this is a five-year study. Because they all go, oh, yeah, yeah. At the end of 5 years, you always say, we found out so much, but we need to continue this. So we had to be honest, and we had to quit this after 5 years. But the first 3 years, we thought, red tails are doing great. There's not really a problem. Look at that next success. Look at that productivity. And we didn't really, and then all of a sudden, 2014, 2015, they did not do that well. So there's something going on. Again, a short-term study. We couldn't link this with food or weather. We suspect that's the issue. But at least we were able to establish a baseline that someone could improve on in another 20 years or 15 years. They can compare it to this and maybe do a little bit better with cause and effect. And then the Swainson's hawk. We were able to get 18 territories, only three nests. These were nests discovered by this maintenance man from Lake in the 70s, Jack Kirkley, maybe he's here. But this is the number of nesting attempts and how many of them are successful, how many offspring they fledged, and that's using Jack's data from the 1970s. So we think there's this elevational gradient going on with red tails and Swainson's. At least we, you know, nothing in nature is ironclad, but we see these red tails occupying the habitats at low elevations. You know, they're coming back to the park in March, they're nesting in April, and the Swainson's are a full month behind them. You know, we don't see them start showing up in the park till late April. They don't start nesting till May, especially at the locations of these data from Jack's were at Lake, very late, very hard to determine. But he didn't think much changed since the 1970s. And then we looked at kestrels. Kestrels are very dependent upon cavities for nesting. There's some speculation that cavities are going to decline in northern Yellowstone because a lot of our aspen stands are decadent and old. They're starting to topple. Now, we are getting new aspen regeneration in northern Yellowstone, but because the regeneration of the forest has not occurred continuously, we don't have a constant supply of cavities. So we're worried about these kestrels. So we were able to find and document 10 territories and watch them. This is one territory you can see these cavities that they're using. They typically use aspen, even though these aren't aspen, but that is what they are tending, that we found them to use in Yellowstone. And then these guys, prairie falcons, we only found 5 territories, suspect 3 additional. And we do think that peregrines might have displaced them, although there is habitat separation between these two. Most of the prairies we found were around Mammoth or Gardner, a little bit drier, more sagebrushy habitat, where the peregrines tended to be more up in the higher elevations of the park. But there is, and this is all speculation, that prairies probably were a little bit, we don't know what they were pre-peregrine recovery, but we do think that some of them were displaced by peregrine falcons. Owls, we only found 6 species of owls, 5 breeding. Most of this is work done by Katie Duffy. She is a true owlophile, whatever you call it. She is in love with them, and she has helped us with surveys. These are the species of owls that we've documented here. We've had close, flammulated owls have been close, but we have not documented any in the park. But these are the 5 breeding species, and 1 present but not breeding. And some of these, like the arboreal owl and the pygmy, are really dependent on the small mammal population. So they'll be very abundant 1 year, and then you won't get many of them the next year. So they're very nomadic. And we survey for these in late winter. Yeah, here's the arboreal owl that should have been in that last list. This is a saw-wet. The arboreal owls are in the old growth as well. Same with the great gray. Gray-horned are kind of a generalist. The saw-wets are more in the dug fir, a little bit lower elevation than the arboreal owls. But very sporadic year-to-year numbers. This is the great-horned owl that lives in Mammoth. There's a nest every year in the administrative district of Mammoth, and they fledge young every year. So golden eagles are one of the species that we really locked onto in the Raptor Initiative, and we have started a graduate project in University of Montana with David Haynes. He's in the middle of that now. He's working with Vicky Dreitz at the Avian Science Lab at University of Montana. But as I mentioned, goldens are an iconic species of unknown conservation status. They occur throughout most of North America, but primarily the West and the North. They migrate tremendous distances. We're actually collaborating with a scientist at Denali National Park. She has radioed over 100 golden eagles in Denali, and many of them come through Yellowstone every winter or come right by Yellowstone. So this is a wide, they'll stay up there if they have snowshoe hares. They don't care about cold or dark, but they care about food. And they'll come, she calls me, emails me every winter, you got a golden headed your way, and they'll come through the park or they'll be outside the park. But these birds really do live at a continental scale. We didn't know how many we had in Yellowstone. And like the songbirds, there's many threats. Arguably, one of the biggest is lead. A lot of hunting in the West, and they scavenge carcasses, and they get lead poisoning. And this is a big issue. If you're a hunter, please hunt with non-toxic bullets, copper bullets, because they'll ingest lead. Is very soft. It hits a bone, and it spreads microfragments everywhere. and we get it if you eat that deer or elk, and they get it. And so this is a huge issue for Goldens. And then also wind farms. They're very, very susceptible to getting hit by these wind farms. One of the most productive areas for Goldens in the entire North America is a place called Altamont, right outside of the Bay Area. And the golden eagles are getting really, there's a lot of wind energy there, and they get hit a lot there. So we did not know what we had in Yellowstone. And we think that, you know, is our population resident? They're not moving. Is it a refugia? So we did that five-year survey to look at what we have in Yellowstone. I thought there would be 6 to 8 territories in the park. Bob Oakleaf, who was a non-game biologist for Wyoming Game and Fish, he just retired, had done some work on goldens in the 70s, 80s, not a full survey. But we didn't know what we had, and there's concerns. A lot of the mortality of goldens is human caused. And so energy development during this time period has killed a lot of goldens. And of course, like everything else, habitat loss. So we established the study in the park, and I talked about lead. And so what we found is we were completely wrong, and this often happens with science. 28 known territories. There's probably more. 21 of those are in northern Yellowstone. And so that's really where, you know, the classic golden habitat is. Open country, rocky habitat, big trees. And we have a very high fluctuation in nest success. And what we're worried about is we actually have, you know, the Northern Range is about 1,000 kilometers squared. So 21 active territories is a very high density of goldens. Not like Denali, which is one of the highest in North America, but it's a very high density. And we think this is a legacy of the large carnivore era, or I should say the lack of it. So I'll go through this very quickly, but you know, wolves were eliminated in Yellowstone, cougars were eliminated, bears declined, the elk population built up to high levels for 30 or 40 years. And at the end of every winter, there would be a huge die-off of ungulates. It didn't matter what the severity of the winter was, there would still be a die-off of ungulates because they were over-carrying capacity. The question was how many ungulates were gonna die. So what our hypothesis is, and we're testing this now, is that the goldens responded to this late winter glut of carcasses. And that's when they nest in Yellowstone, late March, early April. They nest and they start incubating for 35 or so days. And so that's when those females, right before they go down, need food. And then when they're on the nest, they need food. And there's no other prey items really out at that time of year. So with carnivore recovery, wolves, cougars, bears have increased. Elk are way below carrying capacity, and they're healthy. So we don't get that end of winter die-off like we used to get every year. That glut of meat isn't there. And because goldens can live 20 to 30 years, what we think we're dealing with, and we're unraveling this, I can't give you the results of the study, but we think we're dealing with this legacy of a loss of carnivores and a high elk herd, and we're still, the system is equilibrating from this loss. Once winter's over, more prey comes out. This is park-wide, 94 nests, mostly cliff, couple dug fir, or a few dug fir, a couple snags, 1 to 9 nests per territories, strong proximity to rivers. This is pretty high density for the Northern Range. I think the Nally's even below that. That's about 1 nest per 50 kilometers squared, and this is that area here. So the rest of the park, we've only found 7 nests. And that's because it's remote, but also because it's probably real. It's not the best golden habitat. So this is where they're concentrated. But a lot of this is just what I said. But what I want to show you is we really have erratic reproduction of goldens year to year. They're there every year, 100% occupancy. But nest success and productivity are very low. 30% nest success, 0.3 productivity per occupied territory. Around Livingston, Montana, around Cody, Wyoming, it's 2 to 3 times as high as that. So the reason we think it's that low is because of this dependency on this late winter carcass glut they used to have that they don't get. Now they use wolf kills, but wolf kills aren't as abundant as 10 to 15% of your population dying each winter. And then when the snow melts, they get other things. But you can see this very erratic. This is productivity. Look at how that varies year to year. 1 year, we had a dry April. Very warm, very sunny. Every golden eagle nest on the northern range laid eggs. Then in May, the weather flipped. And it rained every single day but 2 days in May. I mean, I sat in my office worried about the songbirds returning and the golden eagles nesting. And every one of those golden eagles' nests failed. So that's what climate change could do. They lure you in April, warm, dry April, and then kick your butt in May. And so we have, this is really crazy. 1 year's great, the next year's terrible, but across the board poor. So what is happening? We're trying to unravel that now, study it. So Dave Haynes, this is Dave, he learned to rappel into nests. This actually is a non-northern range nest. This is on the Snake River in southern Yellowstone, but he's going in and gathering what we call prey remains at the nest to see what they're eating. Also gathering eggshell fragments. We do this for peregrines too, because peregrines went to extirpation because of their eggshell thinning. So we're monitoring the thickness of eggs. Goldens are amazing. I mean, I've studied wolves my whole life. Goldens, I mean, if it's this big, they'll eat it. I thought wolves are tremendous predators, and they specialize. So these are pronghorn fawn legs. So, and that's a nestling. And so this particular nest had a lot of pronghorn fawns around. They're nailing them. But we saw one whole fawn come into the nest. They're incredible. This is the most amazing photo of my entire slideshow. That's a coyote pup. That's a nestling. The last photo was taken with a telephoto lens. We mounted a camera on this nest. I know that sounds bad. I was very skeptical of it. But talking to the golden eagle people, they're okay. You go in when the nestling's 10 days old. They won't leave the nest. So we put this camera very quickly on the nest to see what they're eating. This is a full-blown graduate project on goldens. And I was shocked. A coyote pup. So if it's this big, goldens will eat it. I mean, you should see. Now, ground squirrels and hoary marmots and dusky grouse come in a lot. But they're bringing in everything. This is the first golden ever captured in Yellowstone this summer in August. We're very excited. And he put a radio transmitter on this bird. Unfortunately, I wish I'd given this talk last week. We found her, it was a female, we found her dead last week. And we're not quite sure what happened, but this is her cloaca right here. And it was covered in fecal material and excrement. So we don't have the results of the necropsy yet, but we are going to send her in to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lab to try and figure out why she died. Very, very sad. Conservation can be like that. But it is a data point. You know, we want to get survival rates on these birds, and we want to get cause of death. So this is data. But we were hoping that we were going to follow her for years. Dave is back from U of M this week and to try and catch another couple or three birds this week. This is our midwinter eagle survey. That's coming up. We also monitor the bird migration through Hayden Valley. This is a new, that was part of the Raptor Initiative. And this can be what a typical fall day is like in Hayden Valley. We did talk to Steve Hoffman a lot about this. We're trying to take pages out of his book in the Bridgers, but the other Hawkwatch sites across North America. This is Hayden Valley. It's atypical. What we think's happening is, you know, the birds are coming down the Bridgers. They're using that orographic lift off those mountains coming up. They slide down the Gallatins, the Washburns, and then they hit Hayden Valley and there's nothing. And you can literally see them coming, you know, spitting off the end of the Washburn Mountains out into the middle of Hayden, and they got Yellowstone Lake. And so we, for 5 years, counted them as best we could coming through the valley. It was atypical counting, but we wanted to add that to this tremendous data set on raptor migration. We were not able to keep it going. I talked to Steve a lot. I talked to Keith Bildstein. I talked to other raptor migration experts. You got to be out there every day. We were trying to figure out an index. Is there a way we could do it just part-time? Because we didn't have the ability to staff it. Maybe I should talk to Sekajui Audubon. We could get something going, but you got to be out there every September and October day, because some days you see nothing, the next day you get 100 birds. And so it's just, you don't know when those days are going to hit. And this is just some quick data on that. Red-tailed hawk, again, this is by year. The different colors is by year. Tremendous variability by year. Swainson's hawks, we had a couple years of really big migrations of Swainson's. And they come early. They're hitting it September. But we also got a lot of goldens. I mean, it rivaled the Bridgers, which is considered a big golden eagle migration hotspot. We also, that was our third most common species. But as you can see, we got quite a selection of species, even some ferruginous hawks, even some broadwing hawks, which are kind of off course out this far west. But this just gives you a feeling for what we were getting. And of course, everything in Yellowstone is usually coupled with education and working with raptor folks. It seems like science, conservation, and education all go hand in hand. Raptor folks are passionate educators. And of course, we have some other issues. These are the big three, I'll call those, in Yellowstone. Bald eagles, osprey, peregrine falcons have been monitored since the mid-80s. When we started with, the Park Service started with peregrine falcons, there were none in Yellowstone. And these other two, because of DDT and eggshell thinning, had declined. The classic bald eagle, everybody loves them. They're doing well throughout the park, but we had an issue. We can't get them all. We suspect there's 32 to 34 pairs park-wide. We monitor this many each year by aircraft, and we just want to determine their nest success and number of fledglings to keep track of that, because they were on the endangered species list, so we're a government agency. We keep track of that. Ospreys, the same thing, probably more, but they've declined. And I'll get to that here. This is ospreys. And, you know, they've struggled with DDT, but they have taken a nosedive. Late 90s, early 2000. Bald eagles a little bit as well. And this is related to the loss of cutthroat trout on Yellowstone Lake. So someone illegally introduced lake trout. We're not quite sure when. And that's all that ospreys eat. And so that has affected most of the birds that were, and we probably had 30 to 40 nesting pairs of ospreys on Yellowstone Lake. Now we have three, but they eat nothing but cutthroat trout, so they've really declined. And this is the park-wide. Across the park, they're doing okay, not on Yellowstone Lake. And then bald eagles didn't decline as much because they're not fish obligates. They eat fish, carrion, and waterfowl. And so they switched. They adapted. They're plastic predators. And so a different story of the loss of cutthroat trout. Peregrines non-existent early 80s, and they've come on. But we think peregrines are saturated now. I'll get to them in a second. And again, bald eagles have adapted, we think. Osprey can't. They just lost those cutthroat trout. Outside of Yellowstone Lake, they're doing better. They're normal. They still have the fish in those lakes. And so this is the cutthroat trout. And it's really, in a way, I don't want to overstate this, but ecosystem collapse on Yellowstone Lake, losing those cutthroats. The number of birds and mammals that depend on those spawn, you know, bears are eating the spawners. The birds are eating them all summer long. So this is the fisheries department in Yellowstone is really trying to bring back those cutthroats by killing several hundred thousand lake trout per year. This gets into the adaptability of a bald eagle. This is, we're doing our, so we have two islands in Yellowstone Lake where we have white pelicans, Caspian terns, California gulls, and double-crested cormorants nesting. This is on the southeast arm of Yellowstone Lake, and they've been doing poorly. And I'll get into that in a little bit, probably because of the loss of cutthroat trout too, but also because of climate change. This boom-bust cycle of climate change, you know, you have 1 year that's really dry, not much snow melt, and the next year you have a year that's record snow, and it floods the island. They're 2 feet underwater. But we survey these islands for the colonial nesting birds by flying over and taking pictures. Well, science is, you know, it's done in a variety of ways, usually by just going out each day painstakingly gathering data points. But other times you go out and you get a eureka moment. The light bulb comes on. And this is one of those light bulb moments. We fly over, and this is the Maui Islands where all the pelicans are, and we see bald eagles sitting over cormorant nests and pelican nests, eating the young right out of the nests because the young are defenseless. And so the bald eagles, losing the cutthroat prey, are like, we'll adapt. So we did a study on the bald eagles and the ospreys, and the ospreys have declined precipitously. A guy named John Swenson did a study on the ospreys and bald eagles in the 80s in Yellowstone. We compared our data to him. Like our red-tailed hawk study, you do a study, 20 years later, you repeat it, and we did not get a significant decline in bald eagle nesting success or population size. And when we sent that paper out for pre-publication review, we got reviewers back going, can't be possible. Well, here's what it's really hard to see, but there are bald eagles, and you know, the adult pelicans are all crowded away from them. They're just eating these young pelicans and cormorants right out of the nests. So they've adapted. So more on that in a second. But peregrine falcons, great success story, 36 known territories. We actually think we are getting to density dependence with peregrine falcons. We've seen actually a drop in productivity because we think most of the suitable habitat is occupied, probably Yellowstone. I won't get into this in too much depth, but you know, high elevation, Rocky Mountain forest, lots of lodgepole pine might be limited by prey. They prey mostly on birds. And so we think nest sites with prey availability, we've probably maxed out at 36. Early 80s, there were none. And so this was a reintroduction site. So this, you can see, these are hacked birds only. That means released birds, number of birds released per year. And then these are young fledged. So you can see this is Bob Oakley's work, Wyoming Game and Fish, how this grew. And then we got natural reproduction, immigration into the park. And we feel we have a saturated peregrine falcon population now. This is one of those hack boxes looking out over Slough Creek. This is when one of our climbing trips up there to get eggshell fragments and prey remains. And to be good park employees, we, believe it or not, we pitched these. They never took the hack boxes out. So we threw them over the cliff and got them at the bottom. So this was litter. We got them. And so this is, you gotta go to Teller Falls. Right a little ways past the store, there's a pair of peregrines that nest there every year. They switch back and forth to the cliff on the side of the road or the cliff on the other side, and they're there for people every year. You know, if you've ever seen a peregrine up close, you're addicted. You're caught for life. Got to be one of the most beautiful birds there is, even up there with the warblers. And this is Grand Canyon Yellowstone. This is further upriver. This is classic peregrine habitat. I just took this picture with a camera that I put at the end of my spotting scope. But this is in the Grand Canyon Yellowstone. Whenever you get big cliffs by water with songbirds or shorebirds or waterfowl, you're gonna get peregrines. The classic peregrine nest here. And again, you know, some folks think some of these sites have been used for centuries. So they, you know, were extirpated due to DDT eggshell thinning, but they were restored, and they probably picked out these exact same nest sites. Teddy Roosevelt recorded, I can't remember, 1904, 1905. His favorite bird was a golden eagle, but he also noted seeing peregrine falcons at Tower Falls. So very likely using the same nest cliffs that we see them using now. Great story. This is the nest on the other side of the river. You can see their three eggs. Terrible nest makers. Their original name was a long-toed falcon because they actually slipped their toes underneath their eggs to incubate, but not well known for nests. They've kind of stabilized. This is territorial pairs since the 80s, but productivity, brood size, nesting success has all kind of, we think we've hit saturation. So swans. Swans might be our best data set, our longest story, maybe our most iconic bird. First data we have on them from Yellowstone's 1917. Swans in the early 60s, there were only 4,000 across North America. Some of the last swans in North America were in the GYE, Yellowstone and Red Rock Lakes. Red Rock Lakes National Wildlife Refuge was made a refuge because of swan conservation. Their numbers were that low. George Wright, an iconic wildlife biologist with the Park Service, was a swan enthusiast. He recommended Red Rocks get established for swans. So the only place in the lower 48, mid-century 1930s, that had trumpeter swans were Yellowstone and Red Rocks. There was another population later discovered in Alberta, but 1960s, only 4,000 continent-wide. Now it's about 60,000 or so, but swans in the park and nearby Grand Teton Island Park are still struggling. Our peak number of nesting pairs was 17, over 60 birds. Now we only have two nesting pairs. Our counts in the fall are in the mid-20s. And so we're not sure what happened. So we've initiated a graduate project with trumpeter swans right here at Montana State with Jay Rotella and the grad student Evan Shields, who worked on wolves, cougars, and the bird program in Yellowstone. Evan just started this fall. And so we want to figure out what's happening with trumpeters. This is a photo from Hayden Valley this fall. Classic trumpeter. They're scraping up the bottom, using their long neck to, you know, recover food from the bottom that they're kicking up. Both of them are doing it. This is a pair. They're the best. You know, wolves, people constantly, you know, they're monogamous. They mate for life. They're great parents. There's cracks in that story. You know, wolves will remate. They're not necessarily monogamous if the situation presents itself. Swans, you can't say anything bad about them. They will mate for life. They lose a mate, they almost seem like they mourn. I have never seen more fastidious parents. They're great. So this is a pair bond. Here, a duck trying to gather some food coming up from the swan, going deeper. And so this is what I just told you about. This is 1931. This is cygnets fledged. This is total numbers. And we've been in a nosedive with swans too. Reproduction. So very concerned. We don't know why. And so one of the first things I did with swans, I admit I didn't know much about them. I established a workshop, invited swan experts from across North America in, and classic science, no consensus. So the purpose of the workshop was to determine why swans are declining in Yellowstone and what do we do? And on both questions, we had no consensus. So we have to, you know, quite oftentimes, as you guys know, because you're such science and bird aficionados, you know, you have science and you have management. So we can't reach agreement for science, but we're stuck with having to make a decision right now. So it was kind of one of those deals, when we're down to two pairs, we're going to do something. And so we decided that we've got to do these things. Obviously, coordination with outside entities is key, but we really wanted to, we had some people literally said, study it and wait. You can't take action until you know what's going on. and other people said, you got to do something or you're going to lose them. So these were the different ideas that came up, you know, climate change, drying of wetlands. Red Rocks used to feed swans. They quit that. So we might not, you know, that was a swan factory. And they felt they had too many. So they were trying to lower numbers. So maybe we weren't getting dispersal. Maybe we had genetic depression, predation. I won't get into that in detail, but certainly predators are always an issue. One of the leading swan experts in the GYE who got her master's at University of Idaho in Yellowstone in the 1980s, Ruth Shea, feels that fish stocking in the 30s, 40s, and 50s of Yellowstone, which was the heyday of the swan, but we stocked fish, I use the royal we, the Park Service, and then we advertised these fishing opportunities to the public, and they trampled or went in and bothered where the swans were. She still to this day believes that's the leading cause. And then, you know, again, climate change can be drying or flooding. So all these are still on the table. But we're still looking at climate change. Cold, wet springs are fatal to swans. We've learned that. Last two springs were cold, wet. Neither of our pairs even attempted to nest. So they'll live 20 to 30 years. So they're a K-selected species, which means if it's a bad year, they sit it out. A songbird who lives 5 to 6 years, you can't sit it out. It's a bad year, you got to try, because you're only going to get a couple shots, 3 or 4 maybe. A swan, you might get 20 shots, 25 if you're lucky. Bad year, you sit it out. Cold, wet springs, they hate. So we had to do something. What did we do? Well, this is getting into the whys. These are why we swan, you know, flooding was a factor, egg predation, cygnet predation, some human disturbance, some unknown. So these are all the reasons why swans, and this was a write-up that Kelly Prophet, who works for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks right now, she just took existing data and wrote it up. She did a great job. She established the trend line in our decline, but we're trying to go beneath that one level more. And so since that time, oh, and this is the bald eagle thing again. I mentioned them killing the colonial nesting birds. This is a flight I did to Riddle Lake, one of the only two nesting territories in the park. I fly over one day, and I see a cygnet floating upside down with feathers all over. What the heck happened? I circle this situation, take a few pictures, and I see a bald eagle drying its wings in the tree. And one of my technicians did a flight a few weeks later and saw an eagle swimming to shore, in the water, swimming to shore. They were dive bombing the cygnets, and they were killing the cygnets every year. And it was very interesting. This is another one of those light bulb moments I got to tell you the story about. But they're doing it every year, 2 to 3 to 4 days after July 15th. What the heck is going on with mid-July at Riddle Lake? Well, July 15th, it opens up because it's a BMA, a bear management area, and they close the lake to human entry to July 15th. So this pair of swans doesn't know people. They're wild swans, and so they nest, and their cygnets are born early July, first couple weeks of July. You know, every spring's a little variable. Long incubation, 35 days. Swans have the longest period from nest initiation to fledgling of any bird in the Rockies, 110 days. That might be another factor why they're not doing well in Yellowstone. The season's getting more variable. But anyways, so soon as the lake opens up to humans hiking in, it's a 3-mile hike to Riddle Lake, very beautiful if you've ever been. People start hiking in. When those swans see you, they've been living in solitude because of the bear management closure. You walk in and everybody, they're a big white bird. Everybody walks up to the shore and wants to take a picture of them. They're frightened. They're in the cover, the thick vegetation along the edge of the lake. They swim out in the middle of the lake to get away from you. No harm intended. I'm not blaming anybody. But what happens? This. They got no cover, and these guys dive bomb them every year. So our other pair of swans lives at Grebe Lake. They're habituated. It's not a BMA. They see people all the time. People walk up to them and they sit there right offshore. So it took us a while to figure out, I used to think swan's a swan's a swan. These guys, very sensitive to people. Grebe, swans, not at all. Have to have a different management approach. This was very hard to do. So now we close Grebe Riddle till September 1st. Because you got to keep those swans having access to this thick vegetation. People don't like that, by the way. I'm a taxpayer. I should have access to this park. And you're closing my favorite spot all summer? Does not work well. But sure enough, and I called many swan experts about this, a cygnet's about the size of a can of goose on September 1st. You can open the lake then. Boom, September 2nd, we got a dead cygnet. Bald eagle dive bombed it. We have to keep that lake closed till September 15th. And the pair can only raise one cygnet each year. One year they had five. Another year they had four. Some years they have three. They only get one out because it's a battle between these bald eagles who are hunting these cygnets every year. You should see, watch the swans at Riddle Lake. They never let their cygnets get further than this wall. At Grebe Lake, they're down by Steve, floating away, because they're not being dive bombed by bald eagles. Very fascinating story, and it's an interaction between two of our mortality factors, human disturbance and predation. And it took us a few years to figure this out, but it was all brought on by, wow, how did this happen? And geez, it's always around mid-July, right when the lake opens up. So that's why last year it's open, because they didn't nest because it was a cold, wet spring. So just watch that management on those lakes. I kind of zipped through this. This is a cygnet. The other thing we're doing at Grebe Lake is we felt the nest there was on shore, and every year I was there, the first 5 years, the nest flooded. So we thought, wow, we're going to solve that. This was difficult again. We brought in a floating nest platform. And so now the nest goes up and down with the water level. And so that pair, long-lived bird, the last data of swans nesting at Grebe Lake was 1952. And so we thought, wow, we got to jumpstart this pair. So we went in and took their eggs. I know this sounds bad. Took it from them, put wooden eggs under them, same way. They look exactly the same way. Took them to a facility in Jackson, incubated their eggs, and brought them back as cygnets. Day old, and they're precocial. If you don't bring them back the day they hatch, they're running around the next day, literally. And so we have been doing that to eliminate another cause of the decline, nest predation on eggs, because we've documented ravens pecking at these eggs. And so this is all based on this workshop where we weren't able to find out, reach consensus what's happened. And so this is one day when we brought those two cygnets back. And this, you should never anthropomorphize for animals, but this is a look like, how did you go from egg to this in seconds? I swear, that was the look. And I was there, and I was freaking out. There's no way, you know, I'm a wolf guy. I shouldn't admit that. There's no way she's going to accept him. No problem. Best parents in the world. And then the other, this is Bill Long. He was a game warden, Wyoming Game and Fish, 30 years. He's like all you bird folks. He is a passionate bird guy. His bird of choice is swans. He is raising 25 to 30 semi-wild, semi-tame cygnets for release each year throughout the Western United States to restore trumpeter swans because of the issue I told you about. And every year we get, this year we got eight. This is Brenna Cassidy, one of the technicians releasing. These are probably 90 to 100-day-old cygnets. I don't think this is good as giving them day-old chicks. Those day-old chicks, you know, that's the best. But this is, you know, they don't have their parents. Their life history is to spend their entire first year with their parents. Again, great family, great virtuous, moral birds. but we kick these guys out before they can fly. And this is Yellowstone River in Hayden Valley. And they kind of follow some of the older birds. This is a staging area for a lot of swans. And we're building up numbers that way. So long story short, we have two new swan pairs in Yellowstone. They have not nested or had cygnets yet, but they are territorial. They have a pair bond. So we're really hoping. It's a 10-year plan. Unfortunately, a long-lived bird, it takes 3 to 5 years for them to get going. These releases, this is this fall. This is Karen, this is the Lauren Walker, who's the PhD student who just started in Yellowstone. And this is the division chief for the Center for Resources, carrying two swans out to Seven Mile Bridge, which was a nesting area in Yellowstone. It's really wonderful to do because I'm used to getting bitten by everything. Swans are nice. They have this snake-like neck, and they can just be right here looking at you, and I'm waiting for them to nail me, and they don't do it. Really, really nice birds. And, you know, people, anytime you pull off the road in Yellowstone, you get a crowd. But here we go. It's and just wonderful, uplifting, and there they go. And Seven Mile Bridge is one of the last. There was a nesting pair there. I think the last time they fledged young was 15 or so years ago. So we're trying, and we looked at the habitat. It looks still adequate, so we're trying to jumpstart that population. We're actually trying to connect it with the swan restoration efforts going on in Madison Valley with Claire Gower, if Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. So we're trying to kind of build this population together. And this is the nest platform going in at Grebe Lake. And the problem there was nest flooding. So again, this is contrary to long-term National Park Service philosophy. We're a hands-off agency, but we're dealing with threats that we've never dealt with before. Some of these are controversial. You have to come up with new ideas, new philosophies. This is one of the best stories going in Yellowstone. Loons are also an iconic species. They're a northern bird. 500,000, there's five species of loons, 500,000 common loons across North America, but they're primarily a Canadian and Alaskan bird. They dip down into the Midwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and they dip down into New England, New Hampshire, Maine, a little bit Vermont, maybe Massachusetts. But that's primarily where they're, but they're a northern bird. They're stuck here. They're Pleistocene relics. So when those glaciers are further south, they love clear, cold lakes with fish. And so as those glaciers retreated, you had the high elevation plateau of Yellowstone, that still offered those clear, cold lakes, and they got stuck. We are the most isolated remote loon population in North America. We have 21 loon pairs in the GYE. 14 of them are in the park, and they are isolated from 200 miles, the next closest loon population, which is Northwest Montana. Northwest Montana is about 65 to 70 loon pairs. So we're at 21. We didn't know that until we started this study. They're terrible dispersers. Average dispersal distance for young loons is 12 miles. The record's 90. I mean, it's not like the Golden Eagle story I was talking about. Flying across up and down the entire Western North American continent. Loons are born in a site. They fly by themselves to the Pacific Ocean and they come back by themselves and they want to start just where they finished. And they'll just go as far as they can from that spot and they don't want it to be very far. We didn't know what we had in Yellowstone or how well they're doing. And so this is that study and we're in the 8th year of this study. We partnered with the Biodiversity Research Institute in Maine, Dave Evers. This was funded by Joe Ricketts. He owns the Chicago Cubs, and he has started his own conservation foundation called the Ricketts Conservation Foundation, and he has continued to fund this study throughout its entire existence. He's reformed his group a little bit, but he's stuck with us and added swans to the docket. But these is a quick flip through the loon story in Yellowstone, which is remarkable given the isolation. This is the wintering range, coastal, a little bit Great Lakes, but this is where they dip down in the Midwest, dip down into New England, but they're a northern bird. And here they are stuck. Just picture those glaciers south and they just got left there. And they're another long-lived bird, 20, 30 years. And, you know, everybody talks about what's the wilderness species. Is it the grizzly? Is it the wolf? Well, any discussion has to have these guys in it, because if you're out in the middle of the night and you hear them, that is special, really special. So we wanted to find out what we had. So we started the study. We're still in it. We have a grad student starting on this. Actually, she's looking at pollutants and how they affect loons. These are all the territories known, and the red ones are the active. So 21 territorial pairs. Last summer, we had 15 that nested. We generally only have about 8 or 9 chicks produced per year, ecosystem-wide. Loons are another one of those birds that are not in a hurry, like swans. Take life as it comes. Bad year, you don't do it. But again, classic, this seems to be a swan-loon pattern. Good year, bad year thing. Look at this. This is number of pairs. This is chicks produced per year. This decline is real. We don't know why, because our intensive study started 2011. But we do think this decline is real, and we're not quite sure why. We've built numbers back up. But the issue here is this, and I hate to keep hitting on climate change, but it is important. Loons are one of those species that if you take a 10-year period, they have 2-3 good years, 2-3 bad years, and the others are average. And that's the average decade for loons. For swans, for these long-lived species, maybe it's for some of the raptors too. What we think is happening is those bad years are increasing and those good years are declining. So nature is always variable. Something's always going on. But you get good years and bad years. We think the good years are on the decline. And that's data from BRI. They're looking at loons worldwide, across North America. They've got studies going in Russia, Alaska, and this good year, bad year thing is coming into play. That's very worrisome. Look at that. I mean, we study elk in Yellowstone a lot, and you can get trend lines that look much better than this. This is a crapshoot every year. And we think it's tied to these climatic changes. So this is a Beulah Lake nest, another big part of our program. Beulah Lake has a lot of people go to it for fishing. We didn't even know where the loons were nesting. Now we know where every pair of loons is nesting in Yellowstone, and 5 of those sites are disturbed by people every year. We had no idea that this was happening. And it's good intention, people, but we just got to get the word out. Kayakers, boaters, fishermen. And so some of these places we're starting to rope off, close, to protect them. We've had trouble. We want to know where they're going in the winter. And so we've put what are called geolocators on the bird, on their leg. We've caught a handful of loons in Yellowstone, 15, 16, in the GYE, I should say. And we've had 6 birds with geolocators. 5 have failed. A technological glitch, but this is the one bird. What happens is we catch it in Yellowstone, and then it goes where it goes in the winter, and then it flies back, and you got to catch it again. And it's tough the second time. But the geolocator tells you what their Latin long is. And so we learned that this bird is wintering off the Baja Peninsula. And then you can see it bounces around here, Yellowstone, but goes down here. And the other 5 failed. This is putting the geolocators on. And so we're hoping to do this a little bit more. I don't have a time to get into this, but this is, because we don't have a lot of data, this is looking at other banded loons in the area up around Glacier, some in Washington, and you can see they're hitting the coast. We're doing this to harlequin ducks. I didn't put anything about harlequin ducks, but we're actually putting transmitters in males, and they all go to Vancouver Island, right off Vancouver, and the males are going, they come back here to breed May, early May, they're leaving in June. Simply to breed. We ban the females. They stay all summer. But the loons are kind of going up and down the coast. Our one male went down here. And so we want to do that more. Hopefully the geolocators will work. Lake trout. I talked to you about that problem already. We're trying to get rid of them to build this ecosystem back up. so they don't eat all the cutthroat. They got hundreds of miles of gill nets out all across Yellowstone Lake every year. And what happens, and we didn't know this till we did this loon study, they'll kill a loon. This year we had three caught and killed in these gill nets. Now, two of them were in late October, so we think they're migrants coming out of Canada. Now, that doesn't make it better that they're not killing residents, but our single most productive lake in Yellowstone is Signet Lake. We think it's a fishless lake, too, and loons eat nothing but fish, so this is an enigma to us. We think they're eating invertebrates and leeches, these brine shrimp. This is another part of our study. I don't have time to get into it, but this female got killed in one of those gill nets. We had her banded, so we knew it was her. So we're having to work with fisheries. There's no shutting down the lake trout effort. We've got to do it to get the cutthroat population restored, but we want to do it to minimize the killing of loons. So these guys have been great. And loons, they nest on these small lakes around Yellowstone Lake. In August, they pop over to Yellowstone Lake. It's a big source. They feed on fish there before they take off on their migration. And so where we're getting lots of loons, we're asking them not to set their nets. And they've been working with us on that. We're setting them deeper, and we're starting to talk about putting reflectors on these nests. But this, or nets, sorry. But this is a problem we did not know we had. The same sort of list I've been talking about all night. But this is a big discovery. You know, and we didn't know we had this problem, because the management approach to loons seven, 8 years ago was just leave them alone. They're fine. We see them around enough. But loons, because they could live 30 years. Some loon biologists think they could live longer. They could be in a free fall and you don't know it. They're declining and you don't know it because the adults are still around, but their reproduction is doing nothing. And this is one night on Riddle Lake. Got a loon caught. It's you go out and spotlight them, and you paddle up on them and net them. It's tough, but that's how they invented it. There it is, coming in, and this is what we do: draw blood, put a band on, make some wing measurements. You do not want to get bit by that beak. You can see Mark with his head back. I've done this, and you know, talk about a switchblade or a sharp knife right there. And she will grab onto you, and they have a serrated beak, so you don't want to pull your arm away. You just got to wait to have somebody come and pull that beak off. But you know, among the most beautiful birds you will see, they're up there with the peregrine. We have had no Caspian tern nesting on the Mile Island since 2005, nor California gulls. And double-crested cormorants are declining, and so are white pelicans. We're not sure why, but it's that boom-bust cycle again and the decline of cutthroat trout. All of these species are using cutthroat trout. So avian ecosystem collapse on Yellowstone Lake. Remember ospreys and bald eagles too. Bald eagles have adapted. Some species can't. And getting Caspian terns back, they don't like to recolonize areas that don't have conspecifics there. So you got to put decoy birds out to get them back. So this is a very difficult issue for us. And this is that. This is their nesting. This is one of the two Mile Islands and one of our flyovers to count the birds. And here's another look at the pelicans. This is how we count them. And same trend. Just like loons, just like swans. Back tonight, I mean, boom. But and this is just pelicans. But trend lines are kind of going down. Bald eagles over those nests. A better photograph than that other one. And this was just a plum luck discovery, flying over one day. I think I'll take some pictures of the mollies. What is that in the photo? So a big part of science is done that way. Final part of the talk, I knew I would have to bring it to wolves some way, but some people call ravens wolf birds. Brilliant bird. We just started this fall a study on ravens with the Max Planck Institute in Germany and Bernd Heimrich and John Marsloff. But we're radioing ravens. We think raven numbers have increased in Yellowstone. Dan Staler, who works on the Wolf Project with me, did his master's with Bernd Heimrich, University of Vermont, and found a third of the ravens in Yellowstone follow the wolves. When we see wolf hunts on elk, there's always a raven just patrolling. When a wolf kills an elk in Yellowstone, a raven is usually there within seconds. I can't remember the exact time, but the longest time recorded to have a raven arrive at a wolf kill, it's a minute or two. I mean, they are right there. They are following them. There's a relationship here. And so these guys at Max Planck, you've all read Bernd Heinrich's book, very clever mind. We want to get at this raven-wolf relationship in a little bit more detail. But we've got one transmitted raven right now. We caught about a month ago. We're following around Mammoth. Very interesting watching how this thing bings around between Mammoth, Gardner, and the Black Canyon of the Yellowstone. They're using human food sources, at least this one bird is, but it's getting up into the forest for roosting at night and whatnot. Very interesting. But this is a brand new study, so I don't have a lot to report on in that. But they do, we did do a census. I put to John Marsloff, who is a noted raven expert, how many ravens do you think we have in the Northern Range, and do you think we have more because of wolves? And it's very hard to know that because we have no pre-wolf data. But we think we have in the neighborhood of 200 to 300 ravens in Northern Yellowstone. This is his study design. I don't have a lot of time to get into that. But about half of them are using wolf kills. So that old ecological legacy I was talking about of all those elk and not many carnivores, and now we have a fully restored carnivore community and the ripple effects out of that. These guys are one of the big ones. You know, a little under half are on these wolf kills late winter. And yeah, so that's our estimate. And we do think that's an increase over the pre-wolf days. So a slightly different story than the golden eagles. You know, this is a carcass legacy like the golden eagle story. And look at the range on wolf kills. So this really is a close relationship. Some people think, you know, ravens, you could call them a bear bird or a coyote bird or a human bird because of their just great adaptability. Yeah, but there might be a hair of truth that they're a wolf bird. So here are some of our future issues. I think I hit on all of these. These guys I started off with because for me, since a little boy, they've always been the gems and the pearls, the butterflies of the bird world. But we've got all you know, Yellowstone really across the park is not the best songbird habitat. We've got these other issues that we're trying to deal with, trying to make birds like the geology, the geysers, and the large mammals. We gotta have your help. So please help us get birds to the same level of this other stuff.